If you think that blowing your house deposit on a supercar is a bad idea, you might want to think again. Many of you will recognize our next guest today. He's a YouTube sensation, automotive aficionado, and suave with a capital S. It's none other than Mr. JWW. But what many of you won't know is the full story, which is pretty hard to believe. But life wasn't always cruising in the fast lane for James, and his young life was filled with many twists and turns. Over the last 10 years, James has built an automotive empire with multiple businesses and a car collection that would even stun the Stig. So jump in and buckle up as we take you through the life of Mr. JWW.
Getting money.
One for the money.
$350 Swiss.
Zurich, 23.
Two for the show.
28 sold.
Get it, get ready and board up.
Go!
Welcome to Mavericks.
I'm sitting across the table from someone who seems to be living every teenage boy's dream. And before I get into the story of Mr. JWW, I want to know what it is about cars that really gets you going.
Crikey, man. What is it about cars that gets me going? I think, you know, at its very core, they're really exciting things, right? I think, as you mentioned, the whole teenage dream thing, you know, jets and boats and planes and things that go fast and make noises are cool. I think when you amplify that and then get involved in the appreciation of racing and Formula One, all of that sort of amplifies its coolness. And then it's, you know, their position in culture and what they allow you to go and do and see and people you meet. But I think ultimately, and not to get philosophical too early, but if you distill down like what a supercar is, it's you're creating fire to propel something really cool forward very fast.
Yeah.
And I think there's something really innately exciting about that proposition that it's like, it pokes and tingles every sense. You know, as a human, what we effectively are a big bag of sensory receptors. And these things, smell, sound, travel, everything, it stimulates every one of those things. And I think that ultimately is what really appealed, I would say.
Feel more.
Yeah, I think it's a feeling. And then when you end up being in a fortunate position of being able to actually experience one of these things, and then the act of driving one very fast, particularly on circuit, that once you've got away the fact that you're doing it, what you're actually doing is controlling this magnificent machine on the edge of physics. You're like you're playing with how this living, breathing, fire breathing machine is propelling you forwards at this rate that you quite simply shouldn't be doing as a human.
Yes.
But you're in control of it, and it's and you're finding and playing with the limit of traction. And I think that element of there is an inherent danger to it when you're driving them fast. And I think, well, let's not pretend that that isn't part of it. So, and I think, you know, throughout history, there's been the glamour of that. Like early Formula One was basically I might never see you again, right? There was always someone, not saying that this is a good thing, but there was always someone in trouble or dying in vintage F1. And I think that the media exposure and coverage at that time basically painted these guys as like gladiators in cars. And I suppose there's all of this melting pot of everything that I've just said condensed into an experience. And you're like, oh, I'm part of that. Now I've felt it and experienced it. And all you ever want of that is to immerse yourself more in it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's it. Plus, my dad liked cars when I was growing up. So I think that was the
step back to step
back.
That
was it. Yeah.
So tell me about your childhood. Did you have a normal childhood? Were you know, were family kind of working around cars? What's kind of the background?
Yeah, pretty standard stuff. My immediate family didn't work around cars.
Yes.
My dad was always interested in cars. So the sound of my summers was Murray Walker's voice, right?
Yeah.
Commentating on F1. And, you know, that was kind of my, I would say, earliest memory of something related to cars was my dad.
I see your uncle was Aston Martin.
My uncle was and still is. He is an Aston Martin specialist. And as it happens, my first job was with him, and he had me changing starter motors on DB4s and 5s when I was like 40.
Yeah.
Right. And that was cool. I wouldn't say, and if he's watching this, it's no disrespect, that wasn't the most exciting immersion in why I like cars. Basically lifting heavy lumps of metal and putting them into old cars, which weren't fast.
Yes.
But it was certainly part of it, right? And ultimately, when you're interacting with an Aston Martin, it's still a really special experience.
Did your dad do a stint in Formula Ford as well?
He did. Yeah. So before I was born, my dad raced in Formula Ford. That's Ford with a D, not four.
Yeah. Right?
Formula Ford. And yeah, he did fairly well in it, but it was so expensive, as it is now. It was so disproportionately expensive that he just had to pack it in because it was just rinsing everything he'd got. And, you know, he was came from a working class background. So for him to be able to go and race, and I remember him telling me stories that he would turn up and he'd drag this old car behind him and he'd turn up on a like a one-man trailer. And next to him would be, you know, the sort of playboys of the day turning up with multiple transport. And I think he raced against Ricky Van Opel, who is heir to the Opel car family, yeah. Right? So he was competing against the likes of that. And it's no different now. Like, you kind of now still need to have that level of wealth.
And was it the same track? Was it similar tracks to
same Alton Park, Silverstone, Donington, all of those, you know, scenes?
Incredible.
I wasn't born at that time. I've got pictures around the house of him in these Formula Fords. And there's one particular photo where the next to him on the grid over his right shoulder is like half an F1 car. Formula Ford car. And you can just see the other guy in it. And I'd had this photo on my like side table for years. And one day it was like, oh yeah, that guy died in that race. You know what I mean? And I'm like, Christ.
It's a very real.
It gets so real. And I've been looking at this photo for years and years, not even thinking anything of it. And he was just like, you know, if it wasn't every race, it was every other race. Someone was going, right? And if you look at a Formula Ford then, I mean, they're not that much better now. But a Formula Ford then, you're basically in a fuel cell with wheels. It's like you're in a fuel bath. The fuel tanks are around you. And they were thin-skinned aluminium held together with rivets. This Boto, the rollover bar is below his head. It's not rolling over anything, right? I mean, the whole thing is just a joke. But I think, you know, that being part of his story definitely intrigued me. And then we would always watch F1 and... because he's always had a passion for cars.
And the grandfather's role, was he a classic car salesman?
Yeah, so he dabbled in it. It wasn't his like life's work. And again, I was told these stories before I was born that he would buy and sell cars. That he was always interested in cars, and I think he flipped a few E-types in his time. But it wasn't like a dynasty of car.
Right,
it was just like a... I think they all aspired to it and sort of dabbled in it.
And so did you have that kind of like that fizz, that butterfly feeling from a fairly young age, or was this something you kind of grew into as you got older?
I definitely grew into it. I didn't have the fizz, frustratingly, as early as I would have liked. That's a really strange thing. But
you did do some racing. You did kind of quad bike racing. And
yeah, I raced motocross. I raced quads, which is the nichest
terrible sport.
It's so weird. But this came off the content culture that I grew up on that time,
yes.
Right? So me and a good friend of mine, James, we were both interested in motocross. And I think the reason for it, when I look back, is the car stuff was cool, but they weren't flying through the sky. They were dreams. Mm-hmm. And when you're a kid, you know, they were like, well, that guy's doing a backflip on a crosser.
Yeah.
And this guy's going around in circles in a car.
So it wasn't going to like the MotoGP era. It was more dirt bikes.
It was motocross. And this is the same era. Like, I really grew up on the Mike Metzger, Travis Pastrana, yeah. Tommy Clowers, Mike Sinkmars, that sort of era of... And it was real... Like, I class myself as really fortunate to be part of the generation where those guys and that culture was beginning to push the boundaries, like, massively. Like, up until that point, like, the concept of a backflip on a motocross bike was like going to the moon, right? And I remember the X Games when that happened. And he didn't actually land it officially, landed on the back tire and he fell off, but it was done. It was like everyone who was anyone was looking at that going, it's possible. What else is
opens the floodgates to?
Yeah. Oh my god! Yeah. And the whole scene changed, right? And at the same time, in sort of similar culture, you've got Tony Hawk pushing boundaries, doing 1080, which now seems like a kickflip, right? It sounds like so normal. And I think all of these sports then, they were amplified off the back of these few guys who were just pushing boundaries. And interestingly, the quad culture absorbed some of that. And there was a guy who ended up doing a backflip on a quad. And I sort of looked at these things and I was like, well, I like cars, and this has got four wheels and I'm good at drifting. And it was like, it was just a skill set.
They like Yamaha Raptor kind of quads.
It was a Yamaha
Banshee
YFZ 450.
Yeah.
Raptors as well. Yeah. But at that time, quads were still seen as this like agricultural farm kit.
Yes.
And then people started racing these things. Back in the day, there was these two-stroke Hondas, and they had like widened A-arms, widened axles, super low, and center of gravity was, and it was just crazy, like wacko lens suspension on it and all sorts of
hanging off the side.
Exactly, like full arse over the, on, arse over the edge. And but there was no culture for that in the UK at all. And for some reason, I was watching this American content, and I was just growing up on, when I look back at it now, it was clever content marketing from Fox. So Fox Racing, they do all the jerseys and gloves and helmets. I was watching, VHSs, right, of content. And it was brought to you by Fox. And at the time when you're a kid, you don't think about it as this basically one big promo piece, but that's effectively what it was. And so I think my appreciation for content, it was just so cool watching these guys film this stuff. And you could tell it had a different feel to like mainstream media. It was filmed on a dad camera.
I was going to say, very raw content.
Really raw. It felt very real. But when you watch something so raw, you're like, I could do that, right? So that there was an interest in that and a fundamental interest in the fact that the actual sport itself was cool and they were pushing boundaries. So long story short, before I got into cars, I was off-roading on...
What's it, 15, 16 years old?
Earlier, dude.
Earlier.
Yeah. We're talking 13, I would say. Yeah.
Parents were cool with it?
My dad wasn't entirely cool with the two-wheel side of things.
Yes.
So he was like, if you're going to get the motorbike thing out of your system, do it in a field. You know what I mean? Like, do it off-road. But he used to ride bikes. And again, I think he'd experienced other people not coming back from days out.
Yeah.
And like, to this day, he's still like, you do whatever you want. You bring a bike home, I'm going to smash it to bits and I'm not easy.
Yeah.
And I think that's always stuck with me, that even though I can now do what I want and buy the bike that I want.
Never been tempted by the Harleys and the...
No, dude. And like, if I'm really truthful, I think the respect for him is, I'm not going to do that, right?
You have a good relationship with your parents?
Awesome. Fantastic. Yeah, super cool, man. Yeah. It's really great. Like, they followed the journey, and dad's still into cars as much as ever. You know, so the two wheel thing isn't.
What's his favorite car if it was at the moment?
He likes the GT3. He likes, so the 3RS hasn't turned up yet, but he's like, when it turns up, bring it over.
Yeah, of course.
So he likes that. His favorite up until I sold it was the TDF.
Yes,
that was his all time.
Understandable.
You know, and I sold it, and it's probably the one car that I wish I still had, but. The reason I sold it at that time was there was other opportunities at that time, business opportunities where the cash was needed for it.
Of course.
And the cash that was tied up in it was gnarly. I mean, and it was the car that I kept the longest on the channel. And from a content journey point of view, I kind of done everything other than toy with it. And you're not going to...
I was going to kind of ask that later. I'll try and come back to it just around this point of cars for the sake of the channel.
Yeah.
And the audience and what's being engaged with versus cars that have a special place in your heart and how you balance that. I'm not going to go there yet.
Sure. All right.
So you're now kind of getting into that stage where driving becomes the thing, 16, 17.
Yeah.
What was your first car?
Mini Cooper.
Yeah. Color?
Black with a white roof.
Cool.
Nicknamed it Guinness.
Yeah.
And that was, dude, like everything.
Yeah.
I don't want to like overstate it, but when I look back now, probably don't realize what a profound moment in time it is for someone to pass your driving test. Not just me, like generally, it is the definition of freedom.
Mm.
You know, I remember just thinking the most profound feeling I think that I've had in a car, weirdly, is the first time I drove a car without somebody in it, just me. in a car. Because up until that point, you've got the instructor or whoever. And there's always that aura of, well, let's be honest, behaving, but also like, you know, driving correctly and being sensible, et cetera, et cetera. But more importantly, the aspect that doesn't get spoken about is probably one of the few moments of ultimate privacy that you get.
Yeah, nice.
No one's walking in on you, right? When you're in that car and you close those doors and you're driving, you are in your own bubble. You're in your own world. You listen to what you want, think what you want, go wherever you want. And it's that for me was like, oh my God.
Do you think you've ever had as much fun in a car as that original? Or has that amount of fun ever been topped? Or is it just different?
I would say yes and different.
Yeah.
So that time was like getting your wings, right? If I can draw a parallel between, imagine getting your wings and flying for the first time. Cool. And then further down the line, someone gives you an F-50. That's kind of it. So it's like, yeah, oh my God, I can fly.
Yeah.
But later on, I didn't know the things I'd be
there.
That's what I would say.
Yeah. And how much did it cost, if you remember?
17 grand.
Okay.
It was 17 grand, yeah.
Was it a car that you were kind of lusted after, or was just the kind of best you could do at the time, or what?
It was the best that I could afford at that time. My parents helped me with the deposit on it, and it was also pushed, and again, going back to my dad and him taking care of me and not wanting me to be on two wheels. I remember looking at all sorts of other things, because in that price bracket for a first car, it was quite a chunk, right?
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, yeah, but I can get this, whatever, this Citroen Saxo with like 400 horsepower. And now I look back and basically I remember my dad changing his tune between not wanting to help me out on any car until I started expressing an interest in this new car.
Mm.
And it came down to it being safe.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
Right.
So what were the gremlins with it? What were that when you think back?
The gremlins was the first round of Mini. So this was the very first generation of the new Mini. Had Peugeot gearboxes in. And I went through three gearboxes in that one car. And they were just butter.
I don't know. Was that learning heel and toe? Or was that?
I could dodge and toe because I was drifting. I did field drifting. That's kind of where I learned to drive, really. I was in a field. And so I'd sort of learn heel and toe. And actually, when you race motocross, it's not technically heel and toe, but you do rev match. So the fundamental physics of being able to rev match and matching gears was there. And instead of doing it on the throttle on your wrist, you were doing it on your feet. So the sort of understanding and technique was there. But I just think I just drove it too hard and nailed it.
When you
start driving, you think you're Michael Schumacher, and you're absolutely not. And you're still finessing your skills. And I was probably doing heel and toe and not doing it right. And I don't know. Anyway, I ended up going through three boxes. And weirdly, from what was then technically a BMW product, had a Peugeot box in it.
Any idea what happened to the cars?
I actually went to find that car. I wanted to buy it back.
Yeah.
And it was written off and it was done. So ultimately, I don't know what happened to it. But what I do know is the day that I let that car go, I had been on a holiday a couple of months prior with some friends to Cancun. And I'd left the passenger side window open on it for 2 weeks. And it was in the middle of summer. And it had hissed it down. And then the sun came out. And then the sun came out. And it turned into a mini greenhouse.
Yeah.
And I came back and it was just full of mold and stench. And it didn't matter what I did.
I've been there.
Forget it. It's done. That is when you know your second car is due.
Yeah.
Right? So that was the sort of final fate for that thing. I remember the fake leather, the pleather peeling off the steering wheel. There being this
life. I've been there with the mold.
That's it. Exactly.
I've been there. So we get kind of getting around the age of leaving school. Did you go to uni arm?
I did, but I didn't finish it.
Yeah.
So I went to uni. I applied for three different unis. I got into all three. I genuinely didn't think I would get in to any of them. Mm-hmm. And I got into all three and I thought, well, I've got this opportunity. I should probably go. So I went and... The biggest value that I got from university first, I did about 18 months, I would say, of a 3-year course. The biggest value that I got out of uni was the social people skills. the course was because I probably chose the wrong course. So the first course I did, because I ended up swapping courses. First course I did was a business studies generic, business studies course. But at school, I'd already done business studies, and I thought this is going to be an advanced version of that. And I got there, and it wasn't. It was almost the same, which kind of dawned on me that I was like, oh, I'm caught. Turns out I was quite lucky to have had the foundation from school to have been learning it at that stage.
Yes.
Now they're teaching it here, and they think that that is advanced, and it was irrelevant. It was the most irrelevant thing, like, stuff, and it was more like history than anyway. So I ended up doing that, and it transpired that I was basically there getting into student debt and wasting my time on a course that I wasn't enjoying. And I remember this will contextualize my engagement in uni. The Sony PSP, the handheld, launched. It was only available in Japan when it launched for like months. So I remember ordering it, and it arrived, and I went to the post office and I picked this thing up. And in every lesson after that, I was just in the back on that. That was it. So I was like, what am I doing here? That's done. So I thought, okay, I've got no interest in that course and there's no value in it. Why don't I look for a different course at the same unit? So I ended up doing transfer into a course which was called Media Communications and Culture, which is a long-winded way of saying editing stuff. And I'd already got what I thought was a basic understanding of editing, because I was filming and editing when I was at school.
I've read this for holidays, ski holidays, etc.
Exactly. Yeah. But going back, I would say my first sort of entrepreneurial thing that I didn't realize was I would film throughout the entire year of school, and then at the end I would make a DVD, right? A literal DVD. And I would compile this end of year leavers DVD, and I would sell it to all of the parents whose kids were leaving, and they would buy one for their aunt and their mom and dad and all sorts of shit. And it was brilliant. How that started was just filming me and my mates skiing.
Yeah. Like on a camcorder or what?
All that DVD tape, bro. Like, it had USB, but it had a physical tape in it. So it was like digital videotape, and you could download it onto a computer,
yes,
digitally, but it had to play back in real time,
and then you're editing in what
it was free. Some I don't even know if this software still exists. I don't know what it was. It was like free filmic, like nonsense.com. Like I don't know what it was. Like it was horrendous, but it was, when I look back, without a doubt, the fundamental foundation of what ended up leading me to what I'm doing.
Yes, yeah.
Didn't know it at that time. I was just dicking around with friends, right? And I've lost track as to where that.
I think, James, one of the things that I want to speak to you about, and from what I understand, it was one of the defining kind of themes of your childhood.
Yeah.
And this is going to sound quite shocking given the first 22 minutes of this thing. But you had a really bad stutter growing up, didn't you?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So it's something I very rarely speak about, and I'll explain why. But so when I was definitely 11, 12-ish, basically didn't talk. Wasn't because I couldn't talk. Well, I couldn't. The words wouldn't leave my mouth very well. But throughout the teenage years, it was particularly bad. And I think, you know, when you're growing up as a teenager, all you're thinking about is, what do your peers think of you? Are you cool? Do girls like you? How are my spots? But on top of that, when you have, at that time, it was a pretty bad stutter. I'm talking like King's Speech job, right? Like, my parents sent me to every elocution thing you could think of, speech therapy, the full jazz. And it didn't matter what I was doing, however I articulated my face, the words would not leave.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, to the point where it was like, I'm just going to shut up because this sucks, right? So when your formative years, 10, 11, 12, not as bad, you're in the playground, some kids don't really know, and it's, you know, fine. At school, high school, you're like, okay, this is bad. And I ended up having basically a permanent sick note, which would excuse me from any public speaking. I mean, can you imagine that? Like, for what I'm saying right now, it's one of the reasons I haven't spoken about it is because I'm talking fine now.
It's right? so it's, hard to get your head.
So it's a very difficult thing for me to say it with conviction.
Yes.
Because people are going to be like, what are you talking about? Anyway, that's not a stutter, right? But I'll explain. So, yeah, you know, I would... I didn't answer the phone for the first half of my life. Couldn't do it. Couldn't say my own name. If I would go up to, a desk in a shop to ask for something, couldn't do that. No, definitely no standing up in front of class, right?
Did it kind of like breed like anxiety and kind of lack of self-confidence or not?
So ironically, I think the reason for it was lack of confidence,
right?
And I'll explain why. But I think it manifested itself because of confidence. I still to this day don't have an answer for it as to why, but I'll explain the theory as to why I think that is shortly. So long story short, there was definitely a period of time in my early years where I would class it as a debilitating stutter, where you just go, do you know what? It's time for me to not talk. I'm happy to hang around with mates and laugh when they laugh. Chill, right? And so I remember growing up and my parents joking with me like, you know, at least you don't want to be a newsreader when you grow up, so don't worry about it.
Yeah,
you know. And thankfully I didn't get bullied too much about it. I had a good circle of friends and it never impacted my life to a degree where I couldn't get by, but it was always like ever and still to this day there's never not been a day where something's there.
Yes. Yeah.
However, going back to that filming at school, we need to fast forward now to like probably age, 15, 16?
Yes, yeah.
So I'm filming at school and I remember in a fashion that I cannot explain, I felt the need to provide context on camera as to what was happening. So I turned the camera on myself and I'm with my five closest friends, which in your environment is your comfort zone. We're having a great time. I'm not thinking about my speech or anything like that. And I remember turning this camera and speaking to it as if I was totally normal. And my reason behind that was it was the first time that I would have control over my voice before somebody else heard it.
Yes.
Because I captured it in this box, right? And it was this like safety blanket. I was like, hold on a minute, if I have to take 42 to get this,
then whatever.
It doesn't matter because I can either decide that no one will see it or I can edit it so it sounds okay or I can take it again. The irony of it was I did it first time because I had this psychological safety blanket.
The most kind of revealing thing about this stuff, the most kind of personal, intimate thing is ultimately this.
So I remember talking to it, it just coming out and I was like, this is the most life-changing moment to this day, ever. Right? And so from the outside, you know, from the more contemporary stuff, audience would be forgiven for thinking that I do this because I love cars. And I do, but that's my subject. I still, to this day, edit everything. And I film almost everything.
Incredible.
Because of that, right? So we have editors that help. But the core of what I do, despite everything going on, still spend a disproportionate amount of time every week, month, whatever, editing, because it saved my life. And
it's not an therapy in a weird way, isn't it?
Dude, it's beyond that. It's like a magic pill.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, this is therapy. This was, I couldn't have done this. Physically, did not have the ability in my body to speak to you now.
Yes.
20 years ago.
Yeah.
Couldn't do it. So there's this moment where I'm talking to this shitty dad cam and all of a sudden I'm talking like this. I'm like, this is a profound miracle for me.
And was that at the time, was it translating over to conversation like this with your mates or not?
It began to.
Right.
Right. Because I'm finding myself talking, so I know I can talk. Right. And I'm in an environment which is safe. So like the camera would go down, I'd be like, why is that any different? Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think the other thing, and this is going back to the confidence of it, this was also at a moment where I was making good videos and my friends and other peers were enjoying it and thinking it was cool.
It's that momentum.
So you're getting this confidence because there's this social acceptance that, oh, he's doing something cool, right? And then you're starting to be able to like speak to it. And those two worlds, you're like, okay, I'm the content guy now, right? Yeah, that's what I do. And rightly or wrongly, like I've always had a love for filming stuff, but that was like, oh dear, That is me now. That's it. That is my existence, because this is my secret weapon that allows me to talk.
So when you left uni then, did you go straight into something content related or not?
No.
Job-wise?
Not at all.
Okay.
So, yeah. Ended up filming, editing, speech thing happened. And then, that's right. So halfway through uni, changed courses. The second course as well turned out to be a bit of a joke. And I was basically just enjoying social too much and wasn't doing anything. And then there was an IT guy at my dad's work, right? So my dad had a business in the textiles world. And this guy, IT guy, one guy just left. And it was just as I was starting a summer break. My dad was like, just guys like left us high and dry. Can you just come and fill in for a bit and while we find someone else? And I was there for 8 years. Right. So I ended up helping out, and it was mostly because when I got there and got under the skin of it, I was like, you've been running this business how? Like, I remember the first time I started working there, this is before PCI compliance and data protection. People would phone up from a printed catalog that had been posted to their door, and they would place an order for something. And then there was a lady in the office who would write down their credit card details on a piece of paper. And then she would stick it on a spike like a receipt.
Yeah.
And then they would hand this stack of orders to me and put a chip and pin machine in front of me. And I had to process everyone's card number manually. Just stacks of people's credit card numbers. It was insane, right? So I'm sat there thinking, there's better ways.
You know? Yeah.
So I was brought in for this other role, which when I look back at it right now, I truthfully had no idea what I would have done for that role. But it was a classic case of, okay, well, I can't really help out there. What else?
What am I into it?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, of course.
And you end up doing everything, right? So, and through that, just sharing a fresh pair of eyes, you ended up starting to integrate just more contemporary ways of thinking, right? So we ended up getting rid of that. And then the e-commerce side of it grew a lot more. And we were doing quite innovative product development, and then photo shoots that we were doing evolved. And then we basically dunked the printed brochure in exchange for a highly targeted email campaign.
Yeah, to make. So this is the commercial side of things.
Exactly. Starting. Yeah. So it was very much an e-commerce marketing based background that I learned on the job.
Yes.
For about 8 years. And
what was happening alongside this on the car side of your life? What was happening at this stage? What were you doing, interested in, buying, selling?
Zero. I wasn't doing anything. Okay. So I'd always...
Filming had also stopped or not?
Filming had stopped.
Okay.
Filming had stopped, and all of that had stopped. And, you know, again, no disrespect to the opportunity that my family gave me, but ultimately I was working in a very small like MDF pop-up office with inside this factory on an industrial estate in Stoke-on-Trent that overlooked a scrapyard. And so it wasn't the most aspirational environment, and it was not necessarily the thing that I'd seen myself doing long-term, but here I was 8 years in. And I remember, this is going to sound super weird, bear with me on this one. When Downton Abbey was on. When Downton Abbey was on, it was on a Sunday evening, and I believe it started at 8 and finished at 9, or started at 9 and finished at 10. But I remember when the theme tune came on for that, I used to get a little bit of anxiety because it was like the alarm bell for Sunday evening. And then the reality was,
the Sunday scary.
After this, yeah. Probably going to get yourself ready for Monday, and I hated Monday. And I remember feeling this quite often when this theme tune played, and I would watch Downton Abbey and it was like a bit of escapism, and then it would end and I'd be like, okay, back to it. And this happened for a few years, and I thought, I haven't changed anything. Why am I still doing this? Like, it's not great. Downton Abbey's back on, theme tune's playing, and I'm still the same person doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And so I got to a point where I was like, I need to do something. And I did get to a point where I was like, this is actually not really enjoyable, not really doing what I'm doing, you know. And it's funny that the misconception of working for a family business is you're high flying and you get paid loads, and the reality of it is you do everything because you're the family and it's easy for you to integrate and end up doing absolutely everything. And I wasn't paid anything like what people think. And there's also no break from it because you come home, you're talking about.
So was it just your dad, or was it kind of
my mum and dad founded it? Yeah. When I joined, my mum was entering retirement sort of period. She was in and out for a few years, and then she was, you know, full time off. And then it was me and dad.
Was it difficult with that kind of dad son?
Not really. My dad's super chill. Yeah. He's really super cool, man. Like we were very much, I guess, we were learning off each other, because he'd obviously got it to a point where it was doing okay, and it had this established thing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But I was bringing in
the breath of
penis, right? And I was just going, okay, well, instead of printed brochures, which are costing you an arm and a leg and the conversion's pretty poor, why don't you save on all of this design, print, packaging and postage and do it on an email? And you know, it was small, tiny things like that. And then we would evolve it and work on conversion funnels for websites and affiliate links. And then social media came out and we started to, you know, expand on there. And so it was bringing that side of things to something that was already established. But it never got heated.
Yeah.
In fact, it was pretty boring.
Okay, I think that's quite unusual.
Maybe it is.
Quite unusual. That's
maybe it is. Yeah.
So right. So you're getting kind of this feeling that your life is not going in the direction you want it to be going in.
Yeah.
Where'd you go from there?
Right.
Are you looking at other businesses? Are you looking at doing your own thing?
So I mean, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I remember there was a period of a few weeks where I thought, if I could wave a magic wand, what would I want to do? And truthfully, I couldn't identify what the end result would be, but I knew it was cars. That's all I knew. At that time, like, I would read Evo magazine cover to cover, every word. At any content that came up online, I was all over that. And I would like be able to regurgitate and tell you the stats and specs of every car that had launched that year. So I was like, okay, I clearly got this diehard passion for cars. I'm not doing anything to do with cars at all. And I just remember thinking, I need to do something, but I don't know what. But if I keep on doing what I'm doing, it's not going to go the way I want. So I had saved up a deposit for my first house. This is a true story, and I don't advise anyone doing this, but this is actually what happened. Saved up a deposit for my first house, and I went for the second viewing, this place, which truthfully at the time was a bit expensive anyway. But I got this like instinct, anxiety, cold feet, whatever you want to call it, thinking, I haven't done anything of what I want to do yet. I just want to go on a track day. I want to go on road trips. I want to go do rallies and experience all this car stuff that I'm reading about day in, day out, but doing none of it. So I took that house deposit and I blew it all on an Audi R8. It actually happened. And
there we go, kids.
Don't do that. With hindsight, fine, but so get into this black hole.
This one's supposed to be in first gen.
First gen of V8, first gen, right?
Cool.
So
what color was it?
It was black with a sort of graphite side blade,
yeah,
on it, and it was cool, man. And what
was that feeling? Pick up the keys for first day.
Utter euphoria, like insane,
yeah.
Like absolutely, ridiculous, like. Do you remember when the R8 launched? It was a game changer.
Yeah,
and I think it made the rest of the industry stand to attention, because this company that was making diesel estate cars has just made that.
Yeah.
And it makes the F430 look boring. What's
it? Was in gated manual?
Yeah. Oh, so no, mine wasn't. It was an R-tronic, which was a massive fail.
Yes.
Because it's terrible gearbox.
Yeah.
How I wish it was a gated manual, but whatever. I ended up buying that car. So I got this car along with a world of debt. And it was not cool, because, again, going back to peers, they were like, "Kita,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah."
Yeah, that happened.
Dad was supportive or raised eyebrows? Or
he's like, "You should probably consider your life." No, he was totally cool with it. I mean, like, he understood it because he has a similar story of his own. And I remember him bringing back, telling me that he brought a race prepped Mini Cooper S back to his dad. His dad made him take it back to the show. So it's in the family, right? So anyway, ended up doing that. And I was in such a situation that I needed to make that car work for me. So conveniently, though it was still a relatively new car, and being the game-changing car that it was at that time, it was the key that unlocked everything.
Yeah.
I went to every track day, every car show, road trips, rallies, whatever it was. And the people were inviting me because they wanted an R8 there, right? So it was a real unlock. And I was like, okay, I'm living the experiences, but I know I'm going backwards financially. And I'm also not really building any infrastructure up to support this industry that I want to be in. So I started writing a blog. That was what I started doing first, right?
On YouTube, was anything happening at this stage or not?
No. I wasn't doing YouTube at all.
But in terms of others, were the kind of the...
Paul Wallace, Supercars of London.
Yeah.
He was, you know, I mean, he's old school, man. Like, he'd been doing it for a long time. So I was aware of Paul and he was doing those things. But also, you know, Eva was doing content online. And that was more my scene. Like, I was watching the Auto Cars and the Evos and Top Gears. And I was going on their YouTube channels and watching snippets of those things. Because it was the words I was reading in film, right? It's like, this is the best thing ever. So I ended up going to all of these events, but the act of content creation, as you're well-versed, is not a small task, and it's a full-time thing. And I just didn't have the time, having this full-time job, to be able to film, edit, publish, promote. So I thought, I'm going to start a blog and just see how it goes. So I'd already, when I was at uni, winding back, me and my friend Chris Thomas, we started a video gaming webcomic, and we drew these cartoons that would take the piss out of the video games world, and it got to the point where we were earning AdSense off this. So I knew how to run it and how to attract brand partners, and so I took the format and I did the same thing on cars. I mean, it was with this R8, and I was going to events, photographing them, writing my piece on a Sunday evening, and then back to work. And I did that,
and it was free content. It wasn't for subscribers only. It was just
free, openness blog, like nice. Proper old school,
cool.
WordPress stuff, right? And I did that for 2 years, and it ended up building up a readership of about 50,000 monthly, which was pretty good, man.
And that was mostly UK based or all over the place
in terms of the
content, because the readership of that.
The readership was worldwide,
really fast,
worldwide. And there was no real social media promo. It was just out of SEO, really. I didn't put much SEO into it. It was just so content heavy.
Yes, found, right?
Of course. So I ended up writing this thing that attracted some brand partners. I was getting enough ads on there to pay for the finance on the R8. I took that man maths perfection and everything was fine, not taking into account the colossal depreciation. So anyway, I was like, well, this car's washing its face, man, and I'm going to all these things, I'm living the dream, right? And then one day, a friend of mine reached out, and he said, the Crown Prince of Bahrain would like to invite you to his private track day in Bahrain. Turns out,
this is out of nowhere,
thin air. I knew someone who knew him, but they didn't know me. They'd seen the content, and they were like, yeah, why don't you get this guy down. So sure enough, we get on the flight. We go over. My friend who invited me was from Saudi. Yeah. He was friends with the Bahrain set. Get there. And of course, the Bahrain circuit is effectively their circuit. So it was the Bahrain Formula One circuit at night, totally private. And I'd taken the dad cam because I just thought, if this is awesome as I think it's going to be.
Yeah, I want to remember.
It doesn't matter what I write. It's never going to be as good as what I shoot.
Yes.
So I take this camera, and every pit lane garage of this thing was open with all of this guy's cars. And we're talking like McLaren F1 LM, private F1 cars, Speciale, everything.
Yeah.
And that was when the 991 Gen 1 GT3 just launched. It was box scratch, one of the first that was there. Speciale was there, all these things. And it was a case of take the keys and just crack on. So I filmed this thing.
And was this with any of the kind of the YouTubers at the time or not? Was it?
No. This was just me. A friend of mine, Sam, joined. He was and still is a photographer, but he wasn't a prolific content creator. And we just went out as mates. And I was like, I'm going to film this and take some, put it on the blog. It's going to be cool. So I filmed this thing and it turned out to be ridiculous. And So I got back and I edited the video, which was in the same style that I used to shoot back at school. So I'd not filmed up until that point. And I thought, I need somewhere to host this. I wasn't thinking of YouTube at all, but I thought YouTube will do it for free. Mm. So I hosted it on YouTube to get the embed link. That was it. Put it on. 50,000 readerships there. So that video went nuts. Mm. And I think it did like a quarter of a million views in first week or something.
This was the very first video you put up.
This was my very first proper video.
Yeah, okay, right.
You obviously had to create a YouTube account, and I did a couple of test uploads to get a feel for how the dashboard.
Yes,
was.
Yeah.
But the first proper piece of content was that. The first edited, curated, this is a proper video. And I put it out, it did like a quarter of a million views on a channel that had like 12 subscribers.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, Algo picked it up because it was booming. But it was all because it was embedded in your blog.
Look.
Anyway, I was like, oh shit, like this is nuts. I'm going to find out more about this thing, right? But channel was new, no AdSense, nothing. Unmonetized content.
Any kind of brands getting in touch from that video or not?
Nothing.
Zero.
But the channel got like, I don't know, 1,200 subscribers off the back of it.
Yeah.
And the comment section was the most fascinating. And the comment section was what perpetuated everything after that. So in the comments, they were like, oh, we'd love to see this next time. Or we'd see that next time. So I wasn't thinking what to film next. I was going, sounds like a good idea. I think I could probably arrange that.
And was this the first time that you started thinking about YouTube commercially?
No, or not.
Not you weren't there.
No, this time I'm like a kid in a candy store going, whoa, okay, the blog's doing well. And this video's just blown up. And there was access to some cool cars. And maybe I could take this example of content and take it to someone else and say, pretty please, can I borrow your car to do something similar? And, you know, YouTube still wasn't on the cards. It was kind of a happened to be,
yes,
because of the blog. And I'd created this content that it kicked off. And then it was like okay, turns out I could do this content thing. Little did I appreciate the subject matter was insane. So that's just why it went really good. So lo and behold, the next upload did like 2,000 views, right? But I kind of didn't mind because at that time it was just the excitement. And going back to the getting cold feet on the house because I hadn't lived something that I was really hoping to, all of a sudden doing these things, and I was living the life a bit. I was like, this is interesting. So it became much more of a, this is opening some interesting doors, and the lifestyle that I cannot afford is being opened up to me to experience. So if that's the best it ever gets, at least that's cool.
Yeah.
And that's how it went. So I ended up probably doing a video every other week because again, you don't have the time.
And you weren't working alongside this. This was full time.
No, I'm still working my full time job.
You are still okay.
Still working full time job. Still living for Friday to go and write a blog on Saturday. And every now and again, if an opportunity came up, I'd film something and upload it because I'm still full time job. There's not enough time. So I carried on doing that a few years. The story as to how I ended up doing this full time is kind of wild.
Right. You're now on track in terms of you're getting that fulfillment from the car scene. You're kind of putting the foundations and you're doing the right thing, but you're nowhere near full time yet.
Nowhere near
the journey of getting towards that full time.
Right. So nowhere near full time and like scratching a living with AdSense. And I say scratching a living, working this full time job and the AdSense is kind of covering the rent on the car.
Yeah.
Right. So doing this for a while, uploading sporadically, getting on with things. And then out of the blue, Jaguar Land Rover reaches out to me. And they say, we've got this new car launching. We'd really love to talk to you about it. We'd love to get you involved. Can you come down to our offices and we'll speak about it? So I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, at this point, you will go to the opening of an envelope for content. That's just the game. It's a hamster wheel, right? So I'm like, hello, they don't really matter. Like, I've only ever filmed supercars, sports cars from now until then. That's it. So I'm thinking to myself, if Jaguar Land Rover want to speak to me, maybe they're relaunching the XJ220 or something. They must be doing something really cool, right? So I go down to London. And at that time, JLR had basically acquired a production agency called Spark 44. Spark 44, I think, used to be an external agency that had so much JLR work go through them that they just absorbed them and said, be in it internal and do us exclusively. So I get there and they're like, okay, sign the NDA. And they took me into this big white room. And They're like, right, so we're launching the XF shooting brake, which is posh for diesel estate car. That's what that is. I'm like, right. And they go on, they're really enthusiastic about it. They're like, we've got Andy Murray on board, and when the car launches, he's going to drive it onto the court, and we're going to have an interview with him, and it's all going to be amazing. And I'm thinking, why do you want to talk to me? I said, my audience only really like supercars and sports cars. I'm not sure how well this is going to sit on the channel. And they said, no, we don't want to put it on your channel. We want to put it on our channel. Okay, why am I here? We want you to present it for us. I'm not a presenter, right? And they said, we really love the way that you present. And I said to them, well, I've never read an offer script, and I'm flattered that you like the way that I quote unquote present. I said, but it just falls out of my face as I'm driving a car. It's just really what happens. They're like, oh, okay. Well, do you think you could do that for us? And at this time, the concept of being paid for this hasn't even been mentioned or on my radar, because so far, all I've ever done is go somewhere for free to film something.
Yeah.
So in the midst of all of this, someone walks in the room and goes, oh, here's the thing that you asked for. And they show me this piece of paper with the offer on it to film this video presenting for them. And it was more than I made in the last 12 months. Right. And I'm thinking, am I on MTV Punk'd here? Like, is someone going to jump out of that cupboard and go, ah, dickhead. Right. And it was real.
I'm thinking, what is going on here?
Right. So the pitch goes, and I'm going to set up this story because it contextualizes how it ends. But at that time, 360 video was just kind of becoming a little bit more mainstream. And their pitch to me was, we've got this groundbreaking 360 tech, and you're going to drive the new car, and we're going to put the 360 camera where the theoretical passenger's head will sit so they can look around the car while you're talking about this. Like, okay. This sounds cool. And they're like, look, you know, you be you and just do the JWW thing. And we think that's going to resonate with the audience, and it's going to sit on our channel. So it doesn't need to be like on brand for your channel or any of that sort of stuff. Okay, cool. Offer's sick. Like, yeah. Let's go. So I agree to doing this thing. So they fly me to Spain. And when I say they had closed a mountainside, they had closed a mountain, like, the whole thing. And there's this incredible road that winds its way up there, which was the filming road. And at the top of this, we could get up there, and it was like first class flights, incredible hotel, the full works, right? And I get up there, and there's three double decker buses up there. One was like hair and makeup and like lounge.
The full film crew.
Full film crew.
Yeah. Yeah.
One was the media camera team, and the other was catering, full suite, health and safety in there, the whole shebang. And there's production, and it's literal lights, camera.
And this is that you weren't prepared for the store. This is like,
they had not told me the scale of this. It was like, you do you, you get in the car and you do you, and we'll take care of the rest. And I was like, all right, cool. So I get there, and it's full on Hollywood shoot.
You went out by yourself?
No, I went out there with my wife.
Yes.
And because it was like, yeah, she can come. And they were staying at a really nice hotel.
Yeah, yeah.
So we go out there, and we get up top. And I very quickly realized, despite the fact that the offer that I agreed on was fantastic, I was definitely the cheapest component on that.
Yeah.
I was thinking to myself, how naive was I to not even negotiate on it?
Yeah.
But I'd not seen numbers at that time like that for such a small gig. And in a minute, I'm going to explain why this moment was quite significant, because it was my first exposure at that time to blue chip corporate spending. So full thing, they had brand security on set, which was ex special forces who followed me in the car around with a black bag. And if their spotters at the bottom of the mountain, top of the mountain, at different places, would radio in the guy next to me with this bag and say, we spotted a cyclist, we spotted a dog walker. And they would bag the car with me in it. And I'd sit in a car in the dark, bag over it for 45 minutes, waiting for the radio to come on, going, I'm on the side of a mountain in Spain with a bag over it, and I'm about to do this piece to camera for a car. I don't even know about what is happening here.
Yeah.
So anyway, I get there, And despite the fact that they said there's no script and you do you, and we like you for what we've seen on camera, I could go into the hair and makeup. They go, there's your script. They're the clothes you're wearing. And this is what you have to do. And I'm like, hold on a minute. I'm not a presenter. And you hired me for JWW and I wear these clothes. And the corporate attire that they put me in was really lame.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And then they whack you with, when you work for a brand, you have to be on brand at all times. So most humans would, on occasion, abbreviate a Jaguar to a Jag. Can't say that. And you would call sat-nav, sat-nav, not a 10.5 touchscreen display.
Yes. Yeah.
And all of these things. So they introduce you to the brand terms. And then they say, when you're going around a tight corner, you can't cross over your arms because that's deemed to be not appropriate driving style. So you have to shuffle the steering wheel through your hands as if you're learning to drive all over again. You can't cross over a white line because that's dangerous, even though we're on an alpine pass, right? And because we're filming on very early 360 tech, you've got to do this in one single take because the way that you stitched the cameras together at that time in post meant there was no B-roll or anything to mask it with. It was your one take. None of this was told. I mean, naive on my side too, but it was the first time I'd done it. So I'm thinking, Christ, this is like full on. And there's a lot of money riding on. The words are coming out of my mouth right now. So the 360 rig was a 3D printed cage. Sounds exotic, but it was not.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they put in several GoPros at different angles. And then in the edit, in post, they would then stitch these things together to create this 360 camera. No Insta360 back then, bro. Like hit and go.
Yeah.
None of that. So that's why it was one take, because there was no room for fixing this take. And how they fixed it up was, I'm driving a left-hand drive car, and in the passenger side right rear seat, they had this flat piece of wood with a scaffolding arm that came over the back of it. And they put this scaffolding arm through over the top of the passenger seat to recreate where the head would be to hang this camera off it, where the head would be of the theoretical passenger. So when I'm driving this Alpine road going, look at the panoramic sunroof and the 10.25-inch touchscreen display like a moronic robot, they would go, ooh, ah, and point and move at it.
Yeah.
By some way, I managed to do this thing. It took a few takes, but I managed to do a single two-minute take, keeping it on brand, driving like an idiot, or as the case would be, not like an idiot, shuffling hands and keeping it all on brand. Everything was happy. Everyone wrapped. Claps, rap party in the evening, fly home, everything done. A few weeks later, this XF shooting brake, Reed diesel estate car, is launching. And it was going to go on the Jaguar website homepage. Andy Murray's driving the car out, big reveal, boom. So I'm on the Jaguar website, hitting command alt,
refreshing it,
command alt.
Yeah.
Where is it?
Yeah.
Nothing. Video never came. And straight away, you're like, this is me. I got it wrong. Despite the fact there was many variables involved in that shoot, it's all on you, right? Big Christ. So I gave it a few more hours. Still command R. Nothing. Next day, nothing. Long story short, video never came out. This is several weeks later, and I'd been paid.
And did you get in touch with Jag or not?
Well, a few weeks later, because I'd been paid, I was like, okay, what's the worst that can happen? I can reach out and find out what happened. But I wanted to learn from it. Like, surely, like, so I emailed them 15 minutes after emailing saying, hey, congrats on the launch. Just wanted to check everything was going well. I get a phone call. Oh, hey, James. Funny you should email. We were just talking about you. Debriefing.
Yeah, with the office. It's just laughing stock.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Thing is, the company that set up the 360 rig forgot to take the passenger side headrest off. So when you turn around on the edit, it just goes black. Do you want to do it again? This literally happened to me.
Yeah.
Do you want to do it again? I'm like, what do you, like, all over again? Like, yeah. So I did it again.
Yeah.
They paid me again. Right? They paid me again. And after working with them, they invited me to do four more cars. Right. Now, keep in mind that first check was more than I thought was my main job.
Yeah.
And I interpreted that first check as that's a 12-month window for me to step away from my full-time work, try it. If it doesn't work out, I can always go back. But I ended up getting four of those, right? So not only did it give me a window of opportunity to go into this wonderful world of YouTube, I also had a bit of disposable then to go, there's something next.
Yeah.
So the AR rate didn't stay around for long.
Yeah. What replaced it?
Spatioli.
That's quite an upgrade.
It's quite an upgrade, as was the finance package. Again, learned my lesson over the years on that one. But yeah, it went from R8 to a Spatioli.
Yeah.
Nice. Which was great.
And then were there non-competes in that contract with JLR for other brands? Or
yes.
How were you trying to think about it in your head at the time?
I wasn't thinking about it.
Right.
Because I wasn't a presenter. As far as I was concerned, they got the wrong guy. Right. And when the video went out, the rest of the industry saw it and went, oh, he's the car presenter guy. And I think between now and then, I've probably presented for most luxury OEMs off the back of that. And let's just say I negotiate a lot harder now.
Of course.
And the checks are very different. So that was one line of income that came from something that I always thought I was going to earn off brand deals and AdSense. That came later on. The presenting thing is what fueled it in the early days.
Mm.
And when I say it was my size,
it's like the cold of a horse, isn't it?
It's not
the way around that you would expect.
It was never the way around. And I think it's an example of you put yourself out there and you never know what's happening. So as much as, you know, other people who might be on a similar journey in whatever genre, it doesn't have to be cars. If you're on that content journey, it might not necessarily be the AdSense and the brand deals that end up being your thing. And so, yeah, we ended up presenting for loads of brands. And the biggest one was the relaunch and rebrand of Maserati.
Mm.
And so this was the launch of the MC20. And
when was this?
This was mid-lockdown. So like this was like 2021.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had headhunted They'd headhunted the marketing director of Nike. He'd been there for like 20 years. They poached him from the USA. Talk about a transfer package. They'd moved him and his family from the USA to Italy to relaunch and rebrand Maserati. And for whatever reason, they asked me to be the face of that, right? And the stage that they launched this on made the pyramid stage look like Toys R Us. I've never seen a stage that it was three stories high. If somebody told me that Metallica were on next, I'd have totally believed it. 100%. It was unbelievable, right? And there's little me like this big on this stage. And, you know, Maserati in Italy, it's like national culture stuff. So they broadcast this live on Italian TV, like it was on like Channel 4. And they simultaneously broadcast it live on all of their social platforms. The data that came back off the back of the launch said they had 11 million concurrent live audience off the back of that show. It was absolutely insane. That was the first time that I publicly spoke about me having a speech problem, because I was backstage before I went on and I'm looking up at the infrastructure and investment that had gone into this.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, these guys could have picked Anton Deck for all I
know.
But literally, like, the budget was just not a thing. And why am I walking on this stage? And I'm going on with the CEO of the brand. And what was happening at that time was the guy from Nike had wanted to rebrand the aesthetic of even of the people who worked there. So when I went on stage and we pulled the cover off the MC20, which was their new supercar at that time, they were live streaming it to all of the Maserati dealers globally. And at that moment, everyone took off their ties and their jackets, and they put on trainers and polo shirts as employees globally. And that signified a change in culture and mindset at that time. And that was the sort of turning point for it.
Did you get any kind of imposter syndrome or anything like that, or not really?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the imposter syndrome isn't as much of a thing for me. If I didn't have the stutter growing up, it would be imposter syndrome.
Yes.
I have impossible syndrome.
Yes.
Well, I really think, I remember, dude, walking, like just before walking on this stage, thinking, I might as well be an astronaut right now. Like, it's that impossible of a scenario 10, 15 years ago. If someone had said, what you're working towards is this, I could just as equally have been a a flipping astronaut.
Yeah, yeah.
It was that much of an improbable scenario. And I remember having this like this tidal wave of overwhelming gratitude and emotion for the journey I've had.
Total disbelief of...
Yeah. And I remember posting it before walking on stage, going, for anyone else who's like, whatever. It was just a really random,
yes.
I can't believe I'm doing this. I just need to say something.
Just hit you. Yeah.
I just need to say something.
I can believe it.
And it was the first time, and I've not spoken about it since either. So, which is funny. The reason I've never spoken about it is, and this might seem a selfish thing, rightly or wrongly, the reason I haven't spoken about it is, along this journey, I've met a lot of other people who do have stutters. And some of these people, mate, bless them, cannot say their own name.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and they're wonderful minds. They're wonderful minds because I speak to them a lot through email, and how they articulate themselves in written word, for example, is, you know, inside there is such an intelligent, articulate, beautiful human that cannot necessarily.
Yeah.
And it makes me so sad because I've been there. What I've never wanted to be is this beacon of, oh, look at me.
Yeah.
I can do it. You can too. The truth is, you might not necessarily be able to, because everyone's speech impediment, stutter, whatever you want to call it, is different to that person. I, going back to it, truthfully found an accidental unlock.
Yeah, the silver bullet that kind of
is out. And I'm not saying to you, the guy who can't say a word, point a camera at yourself, mate, you'll be fine. That's not how it works. And so I've not wanted to go, I've overcome this thing because I've been filming cars. Like, it, for me, the two things don't gel. I've had a lot of people saying to me, mate, you're crazy. You should really speak about it, because it might be inspiration for other people who have all sorts of different challenges. But I've not necessarily seen it like that, because I'm not saving lives here. I'm filming supercars.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I've never felt it particularly. It's not a noble example.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm just saying,
it's life-changing stuff.
Life-changing for me. But I think my sticking point's always been, it might not be for someone else with a speech impediment.
Yes, that's
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I went on this podcast of a guy who has a stammer. Stammer Stories, it's called, right? And he interviews guests who can't talk. It's wild. Like, imagine that, right? And I'm like, dude, like, that's brave,
yes.
You know?
Does it ever resurface or not? Is it kind of a thing of the past now?
No, all the time.
It does.
All the time, yeah. And it's, if I'm run down, tired, if I'm overly excited, that it comes back in like a sort of childish, skitty sort of way. But it's normally when I'm run down, if I'm tired, that's when it sort of comes back. And I find, in order to get over it, and this is why there's this underlying confidence thing, if I deliver something with energy
and
gusto,
yeah,
that it comes through. If I'm just sort of chilling and that I might go, oh, duh, duh, duh.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But, yeah. So I have to like almost turn myself on, and then, like, how I sort of present is very different to, I'm not a different person or character, but the energy level of presenting in front of camera, wouldn't want to spend a room with me all day, because you're very elevated and you're turned on and everything is amazing, you know?
It's incredible. I can understand why you haven't wanted to speak about it a huge amount before, because like it is just, you can't seem to wrap your head around, like, you know, you've got this brand that is like, you know, really polished and it's really kind of elegant content. And it just, it's kind of hard to comprehend that.
So next time you watch one of my edits, or if you go back on Eddie Edit, it's not all the time, but, and this again is funny how things work out. When I was starting out, a lot of my content was differentiated because of what people interpreted as a little bit of added production value, meaning I had B-roll.
Yes, yes.
The B-roll for me was when I did stutter, I cut it out and I masked it with B-roll.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So I was like, oh, I don't want it to
have forced to be there as opposed to choose.
Exactly. I didn't want to have this jarring jolt.
Yes.
Didn't make sense. I would just chop out the stutter, mask it with B-roll, and everyone thought, he's putting a load of effort. Look at that extra camera B he's got there. I didn't do that for production. I did that to mask that. That was how that started. And then it just became a signature feel of the content.
Yes.
B-roll. So I'm not saying every time you see some B-roll is because of that, but that was definitely
noticing a
seed for it.
Yeah, quite.
Totally.
James, the next area I kind of want to go into, I kind of want to leapfrog a little bit outside of YouTube, and I want to try and pick your brains on the number of different business interests you've now become involved in one way or another. So I know you've got the production bunker. I know you've got a sunglasses business. I know you've got a car detailing business. Tell me about that kind of transition, where they've come in along the journey, how they've come in, business partners by yourself. Just talk me through that one.
So it comes off the back fundamentally of having an engaged audience. So the sort of root of it is, if you're reliant on AdSense and you're reliant on brand deals as your main source of income, that means you've always got to be in the chair to keep that income stream going. And while you're young and you're really enjoying it, and that's great, and it speaking totally transparently, it pays really well, but it's always only because you put out content. Mm. If I was ill, or if I just decided, you know what, I'm done with this being in front of camera thing, that stops. So while you're in the fortunate position to have an audience that seems to enjoy what you do, and you've built up trust with that audience, you're also in a position to launch brands, invest in brands, and become something more than reliant on the direct income stream of creating content. So I guess my first example of that would have been when I invested in a paint protection film company. This is going back now some years. That was as much of a dipping my toe in the water of having a physical premises. Like, no one in the automotive sphere at that time had a physical representation of themselves anywhere. We were all only online. So I thought, well, this is going to be a really interesting base to make content from. We built this really posh lounge and we did podcasts from it, and we filmed exposés on cars and things. But also the sheer throughput of cars that we had through the door, also this endless stream of content, right? So I thought, well, it'll serve that content journey as well. But it was almost a roll of the dice of, okay, this is going to be an example of a case study. Can I put something on the map as a product and a service that is outside of filming cars? And at that time I had a partner, and you know, we went in fairly heavy on that. And in fact, I sold that speciale off the back of that journey to start that. And it did work, because when we launched, we had a six month waiting list of cars, and the cars that came through the door were wild.
And this was purely PPF, or was wrapping, or
this was purely PPF. We got asked to do wraps a lot, but it wasn't something that we ended up doing. We only specialized in doing PPF. And that was great from a content point of view. It was a great, you know, trial as to, okay, I can launch a company, I can launch a brand. You know, employing people is a very different story. And all of that side of things, right? Where you're getting into a more traditional business world, then, like, content creation is ran as a business, but it's an exciting little line of work.
Yeah.
The reality of the admin of running a paint protection film workshop is the product that comes through the door is sexy, but everything else absolutely is not.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, I'm passionate about content. Can I be passionate about the management, running and employing of?
Were you leaning back on previous work with dad?
Yeah, I was.
Nice.
Yes. But the biggest thing that gave me the confidence to go for that was I could put this on the map in the automotive space. Three, in a very efficient and fast time frame.
Yeah.
And so we documented the whole journey of going through it. And it was like the trials and tribulations of what it's like to go through setting these things up. And I started sharing stuff which I'd never shared up until that point, which is also an experiment, like the tiling of the floor, for example. You know, and it was like, well, shit, this is a 30 grand tiling job, and let's share what that
did. Yeah, resonate with the audience, the same audience, or not?
Some did, some didn't care, some really thought it was great. The important thing was most of the people that I found that cared about it were other business people and entrepreneurs who had lived it and understood the reality of the journey. So as much as you're trying to paint this like entertaining picture, because ultimately people are coming online to be entertained, you know, if it's not just entertained, it's education and escapism. Yeah. And so I was like, well, at least as part of this journey, I can share some of the realities. The sucky days. And so we went on that. But the byproduct of sharing that journey was when the doors did open, turning people down, you know. So that was the most valuable thing for me. It was, okay, all of a sudden I now have a formula or a blueprint as to how I launch something, how I put something on the map. Now what happened there was one of our top five clients came in one day and offered to invest in it. And I was at the time when we were in the very early days of talking about Koenigsegg. So setting up the Koenigsegg dealership was, again, sounds super sexy behind the scenes, very serious, right? It was very serious. And so when you're excited, but also allocating a lot of time and energy towards that, you think, well, actually I could do without the investment in this and I could do exiting this. So I sold out of NBN, sold those shares. I exited and went on to next thing. And this is around about the time when I ended up pairing up with my best mate, Darren. Darren now, he's a business partner of mine. And, you know, his commercial acumen is stratospherically cool. Right. And so, you know, when you go,
oh, sorry, he was a client of yours or he was just a best mate from...
Right. So the client which bought me out of MBM was a totally separate person. But at the same time, my friend, Darren, he's the kind of guy that we would always meet up and talk about doing something and we never did. And then one year I met up with him and he'd invited me to the handover of one of his cars. And I walked in the room and his friends and family are there and everything's cool. And he pulled me to one side and he was like, "You were right. Yeah. But you don't look good, man. You know, it's like, are you sure?" "Yeah, I think so." Turned out I wasn't. And I'd been burning the candle at both ends big time. Looked like warmed up shit. And so as it happened, I had the first holiday booked in about 4 years the day after that. And I went away and I fell ill the whole week. And I was sat there thinking, you know, I'm doing better than I've ever done. I'm earning great. Do all of these things that I aspire to. And I'm here ill, not being able to enjoy this holiday. What's the point? And it was around about the time that Darren and I were talking about, you know, partnering up and doing something. So I texted him and I was like, "If you're serious, let's do it." So when I got back, we went away. We did 3 days at Soho Farmhouse, actually. Phones away, 3 days. And we just ironed it out. And we were like, "Look, if we're going to do this, this is how we'll do it, and let's just send it." So I was at the edge of what I could do on my own. I hadn't particularly enjoyed the journey of employing people and all of the commercial realities that came with that. And I think the NVN paid protection film moment sort of instilled in me what I really love doing and what I'm good at doing versus the accounts and the admin and commercial side. Darren, on the other hand, is a commercial ninja. Like, I've never met a guy that can orchestrate a deal like that, man. So there was an opportunity to not only partner up and have a good time with one of your best mates in the world of cars, but also bring on this opposing but complementing skill set, which I didn't have or enjoy. And since then, you know, and I'm more than happy to be totally transparent about that side of things, is just not my strong suit. Like, the actual realities of the negotiations of a commercial space, once that's done, I'll make it look as cool as hell and I'll put it on the map and I'll spread it all over the world, right? So marketing, content, all day long. But the brand deals that I was doing, the value that Darren managed to get out of those, we 10x'd value of the same brand deals just through repositioning, restructuring, and it was a game.
I can believe it. Yeah, I can believe it.
Right. So he, you know, he is really responsible for my chapter one was very much me doing my own thing. And I got to a place where it was recognized enough. The Darren chapter was the J curve. Where, okay, I can thankfully double down on everything that I love doing. And then Dara would just come in and just reprofile the commercial angle to such a degree that it was...
This is just post-COVID, is it? This is during it. This is during COVID.
During it. Incredible. Yeah.
Incredible.
Absolutely. So we had, you know, the best part of six months, Darren and I, on the phone because it was locked down. Typically, we entered into this partnership together during lockdown, and then we were basically on Zoom. But it was great because it allowed this reset. It allowed this foundation on the commercial business side that needed to happen, because as a very small team on my own, all I was thinking about is, what's the next video? That was it.
It's incredible self-awareness. I don't know how many people have that kind of self-awareness to go that actually, you know, this is what I'm really good at and this is where I need some help. And you get that often.
Yeah, I suppose you've got to realize what you want out of life. And, you know, the aspirations that I had didn't match with my complete skill set, right? So I'm going, well, I can make the best content for you, but the commercial structure of it, probably not. And so I'm either going to take 10 years to do this on my own, or we can start this journey now and amplify it and do it as it happened, do it in about 3 years and to a level which I never expected.
Yeah, right.
Never expected it.
How, and I said I was going to come back to this and I'm kind of getting there, but how much of what you do from a content point of view is commercial versus those early days of I absolutely love going to car meets, going to track days, filming with my mates? What's the kind of balance there? Because there has to be a massive commercial element to it, right?
Yeah. It's not as much as you might think. What we ended up doing, one of the reprofiling things that we ended up doing was, instead of putting these flash in the pan adverts on the channel every now and again for random adverts, like random products here and there, we ended up doing long-term contracts.
Yep.
And what that ended up doing was, A, attracting a totally different type of client, and B, because that type of client was at a totally different bracket, budgets available were also on a different tier. So Chubb, for example, you know, they are an insurance company at face value. That's just what it looks like on the channel. The reality of Chubb is they're a Fortune 500 blue chip brand. The budgets they talk about versus the e-cigarette email that lands in your Instagram DMs is wildly different.
Yeah.
But also, within that, you're able to set up deals as well, which are very different. So you've got the ambassador program, but then you realize, as the journey that you're going on, corporate blue chip world sucks at content, right? Like, in a bad way. And it's still approached as a taking out an advert to sell something to someone. And so we ended up getting under the skin of loads of pretty substantial brands and reprofiling and taking over their entire social campaigns, website, brand presence, tone of voice, the full thing. And that was a game changer, because then you're almost locked in too, because you're representing them as the face of brand, but you're also doing the mechanics of how their brand works online as well. Those synergies convert well. But also, because you know what you're doing, because you've lived and breathed the reality of what it takes to engage a real audience, the engagement and numbers also speak. And so they're like, okay, that worked. Take it over for the next 3 years, yeah. Right? And so if you amplify that across some pretty big brands, I mean, I've been a Michelin brand ambassador now for 6 years. Again, Michelin is a really big brand, right? And so the levels that those guys operate in are not your flash in the pan, you know, Insta promos. We've just signed a deal with Lego, and that's price we've been working with.
I was about to say, like, yeah, that, you know, where does the future lie? Does it lie in things, brands outside of automotive? You know, you've kind of progressed like fairly remarkably from blogs to kind of polished content to major brands, Fortune 500 brands. Does it start to progress outside of automotive, or is that the kind of the driving core of things?
Lego's outside of automotive, but right, they won't be talking about toy cars. So it is, and it isn't. It does. I mean, you know, going back to having an engaged audience, there's one thing as, you know, working with companies and brands and setting up the production bunker, which is the media side.
Yes.
But as you touched on, we launched our own sunglasses range. And, you know, that's sold to 67 countries worldwide. The week it launched, it outsold World Duty Free combined. So it was obnoxious, which is great for a week, but it only lasted a week. Like, launch week was, we just sold out.
Yeah. Right?
It was insane. Sadly, we don't do that every week. As if it did, I'd have turned up in a Zonda. That was an incredible moment of, okay, not only can we put companies and services on the map, we can launch products and sell it worldwide.
Yes. Yeah.
So we, you know, to this day, every day of the week, we've got hundreds of pairs of sunglasses being ordered.
Yes. Yeah.
Going all over the world. Right.
Incredible. It's incredible.
Which is nuts.
How do you balance this fairly like hectic work schedule across content, across your various businesses with having a young family as well?
Having a very good team. The easiest way of explaining it. Good team and an incredibly understanding wife.
I was going to say, it's very supportive.
Incredibly supportive. Like, it's not to underestimate the importance of that, because, you know, if I'm really truthful, I do have a suboptimal attendance rate.
Yes. Yeah.
Mostly because of the nature of the business is such that it's not based out of a home office, right? It's all over the world. And so what's been really helpful is Lucinda, my wife, she ran Gumball 3000 alongside her brother Max, 14 years. So in a strange way, she's almost lived a very similar journey. She's done the wild automotive lifestyle all over the world. And also Gumball is ran by brand partners. It's quite strange. And so there's no explanation. She totally gets it.
Did you meet through the car scene?
And so, but it's still hard. I mean, look, you're still away a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you want to just take a step back from it, we have an incredibly fortunate lifestyle.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And everyone's happy, healthy, you know, and it's a step back of going, okay, I'm not necessarily around as much as I would like to be. But equally, I don't work in the army and I'm not away for 6 months. So it's a case of contextualizing as well as dealing with the reality of having to be away in order to come to
it. Yeah. How many? One kid or two kids?
One kid. 5 years old.
Boy or girl?
Boy.
Into cars?
Magnus. Beyond. I'm obsessed with cars, dude.
Incredible.
Like, and it's not because I've gone, don't play with the Scott Ball, play with that car. I think it's just osmosis.
Yes.
Of the environment he's in. He has absorbed it to the core of his DNA.
So a friend recently has a GT3.
Yeah.
And he's got a little boy as well. And he was saying that the feeling of his little boy at whatever it is, 8,000, 9,000 RPM,
yeah, it's
that smile on his face, there's nothing that can come close.
So cool, man. It's so cool. So,
you know, what an amazing thing to be able to share with them, right?
It's brilliant, yeah. Also, what's nice is, I mean, look, we're very fortunate to live in a world of tech where you can FaceTime from the other side of the world. So yes. During bedtime, you can, quote unquote, be there.
Yeah, yeah.
But what is cool is when you've done something exceptionally cool and you put it on YouTube, and then he can watch it.
And it's timestamped forever.
And it's timestamped, and he can watch it and go, that's why daddy wasn't here, because he was away doing that thing. And
Maseratis.
Exactly. It's a cool thing.
So I've got a couple of silly questions to finish this up. I'm conscious of your time.
You're all right.
You've built a pretty unique career, right? You've carved a career maybe in a space that wasn't totally clear. What advice would you have to your little boy Magnus growing up?
So the most profound realization for me, and this is going back to university, is if someone had asked me what I want to do when I grow up, when I was at university, it would have been impossible for me to tell you because it didn't exist. So when I was at uni, YouTuber was not a word, did not exist. Content creator was not a person. Influencer was not a thing,
right?
So to be stressed and caught up and tied up on wondering what you're going to do when you grow up is something to get out of your mind, because the chances are it probably doesn't exist yet. That is the thing I would say. Unless you're set on going into a traditional industry that's an established thing, in which case the path is there for you, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, dude, like, you've seen the prolific impact of generative AI, and, you know, it's just the most insane thing. And I created a thumbnail a few days ago using Midjourney.
Yeah.
And so if we were having this conversation 12 months ago, we wouldn't have said that. So for someone who's up and coming, 5, who's 10, 15, like, are you kidding me? Like, the concept of you having to be concerned about what you're going to do, the option hasn't even presented itself yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So don't even think about it. Just immerse yourself in what you're passionate about, 100%. And this is the thing that if you follow enough of the entrepreneurial nonsense that's online, it sounds like something out of a Richard Branson handbook, that do what you love. But I feel that I'm a sort of walking case study of this, because going back to the Down to the Abbey theme tune, you know, ultimately what I ended up doing is something that I love doing. And the reason that I'm bringing up this cliche statement isn't because it's nice to do what you love doing. It's because the truth of it is, it's so fucking hard, so hard to have the success that, in the eyes of society, success, that in order to achieve it, you have to allocate disproportionate, unfathomable amounts of your time through trials, tribulations, failure, ups and downs, that whatever you're going to do, do it because you don't want to make money from it. What that ends up doing is you go so over and above without thinking about it that you outcompete everyone anyway, because you're not, like, I never once thought I'm going to go into this YouTube thing because I'm going to end up launching an international sunglasses brand and present for all. Never on the cards, dude. I just like cars. So I'm going to go on this journey and share what I would like to see online. I think there's so many variables outside of that core reasoning that it's almost pointless in sharing it, because the path is so unknown.
Okay, yeah.
Other than, as long as the genre you're in springs you out of bed in the morning and you can barely sleep because you're thinking about how to improve it the next day, that is the key variable to it by far and away. And you could apply that to whatever you want. That's the formula for sure.
That is an incredible answer. Right, two really baity questions.
Yeah,
I'll go again. Right, two very baity questions to finish off here. Very silly, so I apologize in advance.
One.
250K, 3 cars. Were you buying? I asked Nico a similar question about watches. 50K, 3 watches. So.
I have to buy 3 cars? Like, 3 cars?
I buy 3 cars. 250K. And why?
Okay. I'm going to do a... I'm going to do a Range Rover.
Yeah.
For the daily driver.
Yeah. What are we taking off there? How much?
We're going to do 120 grand because it's going to be a all fat.
Right. Right. Yeah.
All fat V8.
Yeah.
Supercharged.
Yeah.
Not because it's faster and it drinks a lot of fuel. It's because the engines are much more reliable. They're a much smoother drive than the diesels, and the engines in the V8s are a BMW derived platform.
Yes.
Which is a much more.
Right. I'm going to leave you with two really stupid questions. So you're probably going to roll your eyes. I'm going to apologize in advance. 250K, 3 cars. What are you buying and why? I asked Nico a similar question about watches. So you're going to have to.
Okay. It's hard, man. 250K, full fat Range Rover. Let's just allocate 120 grand to that, say. And the reason for that is it's probably the car with the broadest spectrum of ability, in that daily driver, turn up to the work meetings, great, go to the restaurant, go to the ball, whatever, go over the field. It does everything, it's practical, and they're just socially accepted pretty much.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
V8. 130 left.
130 left. I am going to go for $100,000
yeah.
on probably the GT3 that Nico's just bought.
Yeah.
Right? Which he got
991.1.
Yeah, he got a 991.1 GT3. That was the first of the non-Metzger engines, twin clutch box, 9,000 RPM, just an absolute amazing. I mean, the value is there insane.
Yes.
It was also my first GT3, so I have a special place in my heart for that
car. Yes.
So what have we got left? There's 220. So we've got 30 grand left.
30 grand left.
There's 30 grand left. Let's do a GR Yaris.
Yeah, nice. Toyota nice.
GR Yaris. It is a phenomenal little hot hatch.
Cool.
In the wet, greasy B roads of winter, there is nothing like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, very cool.
And just, yeah, it's good for those wet track days. It's, yeah.
How are you speccing them?
Colors. Colors, I would like a green on tan Range Rover.
Nice.
I would like a GT Silver GT3. That way, as well, it's a broader spectrum of car because you can still kind of turn up to places and not be too up,
not crazy loud. Yeah.
And then the GR Yaris, mine's bright yellow, but I'm getting a bit sick of it now. So I'll probably do it like a navy blue with like copper wheels.
Yeah, cool. Cool.
Something like that.
Yeah. And then this is super basic, right?
Sure.
But if you were a car brand,
yeah,
any car brand,
yeah,
what would it be and why?
Dude, that's interesting. If I was a car brand, what would I be? And why? Hopefully. I would like to be a sub-brand of Porsche. And I would like to be the GT. Manti. I would like to be the Manti GT department because they're experimental.
Yeah.
And they're fast, but they're generally quite reliable. They're premium enough, but they're realistically aspirational.
Yes.
And they're just all around good folks that make cool things.
Yes, some cars.
So I'd probably do that, I think. Yeah.
Very good answer. Well, look, James, that was a total pleasure. Thank you so much. Really appreciate
that. That was good fun.
Hi. This again.
Mate, thanks for having me on, man. Really appreciate it. Cheers, bud. Thanks.